Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind. Until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Hi, listeners. If you're just tuning in, I suggest you go back and start listening from chapter one. And before we start, a content warning. This episode contains accounts of domestic and sexual violence.
I don't know the story of what happened that night, but I do know what happened that day because it involved me. But no one wanted to know about that.
The morning before Nikki killed Chris, two social workers from Child Protective Services, the child welfare agency, arrived at their door.
And as soon as CPS left, Nikki and Chris called me and said, we think it was you who reported us. Did you report us? And I said, no. And I said, Nikki, you know I can't report you because it's not about you. Women can't get reported. It's about children.
The social workers decided that the children, Ben and Faye, weren't in any immediate danger, but they told Nikki and Chris that the agency would continue its investigation. The next step, they explained, would be to contact friends and family. This was just protocol. Nikki and Chris were desperate to know who reported them. Together, they called Nikki's midwife, Susan Ranistad.
And Chris was there on the phone. And I said, how are you, Nikki? And she said, I'm good. Chris is here. And I said, Chris, how are you? And he said, I'm good, Susan. We're going to be okay. It's all going to be okay tonight. And the last thing he said again was, everything's going to be fine. I've got this all taken care of. And then the next day, I heard she shot him that night.
This is Believe Her. I'm Justine Vanderloon. Chapter 2, Deep Secrets.
He'll come up.
Come on, Earl! Earl! Earl!
They're spoiled rotten.
A long time ago, many years before the CPS visit, Chris was just a kid himself. He grew up on a farm in Red Hook, New York. It's about 25 miles north of Poughkeepsie. Today, on that four-acre farm, there are roosters, pigs, a white pony named Cupcake, and a goat named Becky.
The pig lives in here. He sleeps in one of those, too.
There's also a paddling of ducks. Fun fact, that's the term for a big group of ducks. They once belonged to Chris.
When we moved up here, Christopher had always begged for a baby duck.
That's Gail Grover, Chris's mom.
So on his father's way home from work one night, he saw baby ducks for sale, stopped and bought one. And then it turned into, I think we had over 100 and some ducks here at one time, all different colors and breeds. And he raised them and he showed them at the fair and stuff. He loved those ducks so much. Every single one of them had a name. And I'll never forget, this is how fit he was. A fox came down off the hill and grabbed one of his ducks to have lunch. Christopher leaped the fence, chased the fox up that hill, and came back down the hill with his duck, still alive.
So he had like this protective nature about him from a young
age. Especially animals. Yeah.
That was our producer, Julia. She went to visit Gail and Chris's Aunt Tracy on their farm. They told her that Chris found gymnastics when he was pretty young. By the time he was 16, he was working for his cousin's gymnastics studio. Nikki was a coach, too. She worked part-time at another studio. It was called Mr. Todd's, and it's where she trained as a kid. She would see Chris at meets. They became friends. And then the friendship slowly turned into a relationship.
And then he just transferred to Mr. Todd's, and
a lot of the kids went with him.
Chris was 21, and Nikki was only 19. To Nikki, he seemed like such a nice, regular guy. He was into making amateur movies with his brother. He was a black belt in Taekwondo. He liked video games. He liked goofing around. The Chris she met was the same Chris that you just heard his mom, Gail, talking about. That little, duck-loving boy. He was a hard worker. He lived a healthy lifestyle. No drinking, no drugs. He was into sports, and he was into Nikki. His mom, Gail, and Aunt Tracy were thrilled.
She was straight on great. Nikki was the first
real true love.
Yeah.
As you could say.
Everything looked normal, even wholesome. Nikki and Chris were living separately with their parents. He was coaching. She was studying to be a preschool teacher, and she was focused on her future.
She wanted to have her career. She wanted to have babies. That's all she ever wanted for her entire life was to have babies.
That's Michelle, Nikki's big sister. You met her in the last episode. Michelle mostly saw Chris at family get-togethers. She never had a sense of who he was.
He was very quiet. He was there for holidays. He was there and was very like, hey, what's up? That's my impression of Chris. What's up?
Michelle says that in the beginning, Chris ticked a lot of boxes for Nikki.
He was close with his family. That was important to her. He was good with kids. That's all she wanted. She thought he was safe. I mean, that's like the word she used.
After about 2 years of dating, Nikki found out she was pregnant. She told Chris and he was over the moon. They decided to move in together. And then Ben was born. Ben changed everything. Nikki was madly in love with him.
Mama. Mama. I love you. Ben, can you show me your smile?
Nikki wanted to celebrate her life with Ben. And, like any self-respecting millennial mom, she used Instagram to do it. Her IG was epic. I've looked through it a lot. It's heavy on the live, laugh, love vibe. Nikki mommed hard. She'd sew a detailed Halloween costume by hand. Nikki would bake a cake from scratch and frost it like a pro. Like if Ben asked, Mommy, what is the life cycle of the butterfly? She'd be like, okay, so let's draw with crayons, it's eggs, caterpillar, chrysalis, let's go to the butterfly exhibit, let's get a butterfly book. That kind of mom. And I respect it because I've got two little kids. And I make box cakes and I order a tutu online like a day ahead of time. And I'm like, okay, you're a ballerina now. Yay, that's your costume. And in terms of a butterfly life cycle, I'm basically just like, Mommy doesn't know. Mommy's reading. That was not Nikki. One thing that sticks out to me. From the time he was born, Ben and Nikki had a deep connection. Nikki recognized she had a great musical talent on her hands, and she did everything she could to nurture that part of him. Some people assumed that becoming a mom changed Nikki. Moms, am I right? Uptight, control freaks, so precious about our children. Never mind that we're holding up society with our unpaid labor.
A whole different side of Nikki came out after Ben was born. A possessive side, like, this is my child and nobody's gonna, you know, it's...
That's Chris's mom, Gail, again, and his Aunt Tracy.
They're fed vegetarian. They weren't allowed anything. I couldn't even get my grandson his first lollipop. He was not allowed sugar. And Chris just went with the flow because he didn't like...
Confrontation.
Yeah, confrontation. Did not like it. No way, no how.
And if you were down in Poughkeepsie or something and wanted to stop there to see the kids or go down, you'd have to call Nikki first.
Yes. Oh, you were not allowed to just stop in.
So Nikki wanted her in-laws to call before they popped by. I mean, personally, that sounds not unreasonable. But it's true. Nikki kept her kids really, really close.
And Ben was a mama's boy.
Well, Ben wasn't allowed with anybody.
Right.
Unless Chris and Nikki were there.
The first day I ever drove my grandkids in the car, literally put them in a car seat and left in my car, was like a weekend or two after everything happened, and we brought them up here for a little while.
She wouldn't allow her own mother to drive those kids in the car.
And Chris's family really, like, uses things like that to say she was controlling without acknowledging that those moments where she's grasping for control are because she's so out of control in other areas of her life. It's not recognized as a trauma response. It's recognized as a personality trait.
That's Michelle, Nikki's older sister.
We see these things, we make assumptions, and we call them personality defects without really looking at the underlying reason of why. Why was she so protective of those kids? Why did she need to have them with her at all times?
We make assumptions. She can't chill. She can't relax. This idea of Nikki as a killjoy, it goes all the way back to her childhood. Her own family bought into this idea. Nikki, the gymnast, always watching what she ate, always so anxious, a little perfectionist, so annoying. But was Nikki the one with the hangups, or was everyone else in denial? And this brings us back to Mr. Todd's gymnastics studio, where Nikki and Chris worked. It's a big warehouse between a Burger King and an auto body shop. Eventually, Nikki stopped coaching, but she still came by the studio. And Chris, he was promoted to head coach. People liked him. He got along really well with kids. A lot of people said he was kind of a big kid himself.
Chris was like a bubbly, kind of like, you know, very hands-on, very funny, always made the kids feel really, really comfortable, energetic, you know, joked around a lot, never wanted to see them upset.
That's Nicole Hepler, a Mr. Todd's gymnastics mom. Both Nikki and Chris coached Nicole's daughter, Abby.
If Abby was having a bad day, I would, you know, Abby had a lot of anxiety. So I would say, like, Abby's freaking out today. She doesn't want a back tumble. And he's like, I'll handle it. I'll talk to her. And it was a simple email, whatever. And then I would get to the gym to drop Abby off. And I would say, you're going to talk to her? And he's like, I got it. You can go home.
Nicole was also friendly with Nikki. And she noticed that over time, Nikki sort of receded from the Mr. Todd's community. And people talked.
Nikki was Nikki, you know, always had kind of an ailment going on. There was always a little something wrong. You know, we would ask, you know, oh, where's Nikki? Oh, she's not feeling good. She's staying home. She's doing this, you know, and that was that. I feel like Nikki... She had a whole group of people that she showed abuse to or signs of abuse, you know, but yet we never knew it or saw it. I never really saw him mad, you know. Chris was Chris. I mean, Abby was with Chris every day, and I am a pretty good judge of character. If I thought something was going on, I myself would have went to the owner and been like, what is going on? You need to fix that.
So Nicole Hepler, she's operating under this logic that her experience with a person is the only experience with that person. For Nicole, it seems that she couldn't wrap her mind around the possibility that Nikki was being hurt. And she certainly could not imagine that Chris would hurt somebody. Other people in the gymnastics studio and in Nikki's life, they saw things differently. Literally saw things differently. We'll hear from some of those people after the break.
He would lie his way into their dreams.
He was looking for James Bond girls.
How fun would that be to be a Bond girl?
Then twist them into a nightmare.
This guy has done this before. He'll do it again.
Until a group of women banded together to put him behind bars and keep him there.
You have to participate fiercely, fiercely in what happens next.
I'm Keith Morrison, and this is Murder in the Hollywood Hills, an all-new podcast from Dateline.
Listen to Murder in the Hollywood Hills for free each week or subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com to unlock new episodes 1 week early.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
I had a condo that I was had recently put up for rent. It was a one-bedroom condo. Nikki and Chris were interested in renting it.
Lori Horning is a social worker. She owned a rental condo, and she was looking for a new tenant. Ben was nearly a year old, and the family needed more space. They went to see Lori's apartment.
Ben was, you know, kind of toddling around as, you know, little ones do. I actually remember him. He threw up on my couch. And Nikki was so apologetic. And I was like, it's totally fine.
Nikki and Chris decided to rent the condo. And that's how Nikki and Lori met. They got along. They kept in touch. They had some mutual friends. Lori was pretty used to people talking to her about personal matters. People with quite intimate questions tend to make a beeline for the social worker at the barbecue or the cocktail party or the playground. And as their relationship developed, Nikki began to ask Lori intimate questions of her own.
The first time she really kind of talked to me about Chris is she was almost like asking me about what did consent look like. She doesn't have to consent to sex just because somebody's her partner. Like, you can say no, you're not obligated.
That's what you're explaining to her.
Yeah, we kind of like opened the door. I can't remember the exact question that she asked me, but it definitely had to do with her not wanting to have sex with Chris.
Nikki and Chris decided to renew their lease for another year. So, one winter day, Lori stopped by to collect the new agreement. At the time, Nikki was pregnant with her second child, Faye.
So I, you know, park my car, walk down to the building, go upstairs and knock on the door. Nikki answers the door. When she answered the door, I was really taken aback by her appearance because it looked like she had been strangled with some sort of like a rope or a wire. And her one eye had blood spatters in it and her lip, she had a fat lip. And she was, you know, she's petite and she was pretty pregnant at the time. So she was showing. And I just remember thinking like, oh, my God, here's this girl that's, you know, I don't know. She was at least 6 months pregnant at the time, you know, with these horrible injuries on her. And so she opened the door and let me in. And so I came in and sat down and like Ben came over. And at first he was being really shy. And I remember thinking like, I don't really know what to do right now. And then somebody knocked on the door and she scoops Ben up so fast and was like, who is that? And I'm like thinking, I'm like, why are you asking me? I don't live here.
Nikki had all these marks all over her and she was flipping out. And Lori's thinking, what have I walked into?
And they knocked again. And she's like, who is that? And was really in this complete state of panic. Like, I remember just this, like, wave of anxiety coming over me. And then I was like, Nikki, who is that? Like, in my head, I'm like, holy shit, like, is this Chris? Like, did he, maybe now he knows I'm here and I'm seeing her with these marks all over her. And I remember thinking in my head, like, okay, we could go and lock the bedroom door and, like, I could help her and Ben climb out the window. Like, I just was, like, automatically thinking of, like, this escape plan. And then, like, you heard somebody pull away and she went and looked at the curtains and it was the mailman. I was, like, terrified. And I was terrified for her. And I was, like, thought to myself, like, this guy, you know, could hurt us all. We made this plan around that time that, like, if Nikki ever texted me the words go, that I should call 911.
Lori knew that Nikki needed help, a support system, and she thought a therapist would be a good first step. Through her job, Lori knew Sarah Caprioli, a trauma therapist who treated victims of violence. She introduced Nikki to Sarah.
At the beginning of their relationship, Nicole actually described him as being very patient and would kind of stop if she asked him to stop. And then as time went on, he became less and less patient. And if she said no, he would force her or he would coerce her into doing it by reminding her that this was her role.
Sarah and Nikki worked together for about 2 years. Throughout that time, Sarah says, she began to unravel how Chris had evolved from a kid who loved his ducks into a seriously abusive partner. Sarah says that Nikki told her that Chris had been patient in the beginning, that he held out on having sex because she wanted to. But then he started to abuse her, little by little. He stopped when she was pregnant with Ben. And then, shortly after Ben's birth, he started to get very violent. In her first assessment of Nikki, Sarah noted that Nikki presented with symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Part of Sarah's treatment plan included educating Nikki on how abuse can play out within the context of a relationship.
One of the things that we did in our work together was education about what domestic violence is. And she began to start to identify it for herself and understand a little bit more about coercive control and intimidation.
As their work together continued, it became clear to Sarah that Chris was raping Nikki and that it was happening more and more.
Sometimes he would hold her down and sometimes he would do it by intimidating her.
And Sarah came to understand that Chris had begun to hit Nikki when she refused sex. At first, Nikki rationalized his behavior. Remember, she was young. She was only 19 when they first started dating. Nikki thought,
if I just learn to like it, if I just do what he says, then it will be okay and he's going to stop and then we could be a normal family. What she wanted more than anything was to be a family. She didn't want to break up her family. She just wanted the violence to stop.
The violence didn't stop. It rarely does. Things were just getting worse. Sarah urged Nikki to go to authorities, but Nikki didn't want to.
It's not unusual at all that a victim of sexual violence would not want to report. It is an incredibly shameful, traumatic thing to have happen. And victims are fearful that if they report, then something might get worse for them.
So Nikki wasn't ready to report, but Sarah did convince her to start documenting. Sarah knew the system. She had worked with cops and lawyers. She knew that if a woman wanted a restraining order or had to go through a custody battle, it was crucial to have evidence. A victim's word is not enough. A court won't believe her on the strength of her testimony alone. But hard documentation? Who can argue with that? One of the people that Sarah believed could provide Nikki with that kind of documentation was Nikki's midwife, Susan Ranestad. You heard from her at the beginning of this episode.
I've been working with pregnant families for 38 years and catching babies about 31.
Susan is a licensed midwife in New York State, and she has a pretty specific client base.
You know, we call them the granola moms. They're all into a more natural parenting. They want to make their own baby food. you know, they want to have a beautiful life and they want their child to like learn from their toys. Those moms are tight.
Nikki had found the OBGYN experience with her son Ben to be especially invasive. So when she got pregnant with Faye, she decided she wanted to have a home birth. And Susan noticed right away that something was off with Nikki.
She was like delicate and wounded from the get-go.
Immediately, Susan knew there was more to the story.
She's a beautiful young woman. Her makeup was pancaked on, and she wore makeup on other parts of her body. One day I actually went and got a washcloth and held her arm and washed it off to see the bruising. She wouldn't tell me outright what happened. She would answer questions, though, and I could ask specific questions. But if I said it was Chris, she would nod.
Nikki was in pain constantly, and she was worried about her health. The evidence of what was happening to her was on her body.
She started coming to me then when she was hurt. And she'd want to be examined, but she was terrified to be examined. You know, if I was looking at a bruise on her collarbone, she would turn away. You know, she wanted me to see it. She didn't want me to see it. It was very hard for her to admit that it was happening.
Susan would ask and Nikki would deflect, but there's only so much you can brush off.
Like when I'm looking at her bottom that's torn, I'm like, what did this? And she would cover her face. And then I would guess, was it wooden? Was it plastic? Was it a sex toy?
To be clear, it wasn't just that Nikki was bruised, that she had strangulation marks on her neck, black eyes, fat lips. Nikki had injuries to her pelvis, as well as internal injuries and serious bruising and swelling. Touch was so excruciating that Susan could not properly perform a vaginal exam.
She had disclosed that he had used the gun on her sexually. So I knew about a year and a half before he died that he had a gun. I knew it was locked up. I knew she couldn't get her hands on it because I said to her, is it in the house? Because I'll come and take it out and take it to the cops. Tell them I found it.
But Susan never did go to the cops. Plus, Chris had a permit for the gun. Susan says that throughout her time seeing Nikki, she witnessed some strange things. Sometimes, Nikki skipped her prenatal appointments, but other times, when she did show up, Nikki would text Chris to bring cash for payment.
When it came to pay me, he dropped her at her visit, and then when we were done, she called him back. Everyone gives me a check or a credit card, gets points. Who gives you $5,000 without getting points? And I just want to say, what is Mr. Gym Teacher doing with wads of cash and a gun?
Everyone has a theory about what was happening. According to Nikki, Chris coached some kids privately, and in her recollection, clients did pay him with cash. But even so, I have questions. How much access did Nikki have to the family money? Several people I've talked to for this story mentioned that Chris completely controlled the finances. Nikki didn't have a job or an income, but she sewed baby booties by hand and sold them for about $30 a pair. Chris allowed her to keep that money. He called it her play money. It was $1,000 in a good year, she told me, and she mostly used it to buy her kids Christmas presents. That kind of financial control is paralyzing. But paired with the other types of control, it's all-consuming. The other stuff Susan the midwife is describing, the severe sexual violence, that sort of thing is usually rooted in dark sexual fantasies. It's worth noting that Chris left a digital trail that suggests an obsession with sadistic pornography. According to his search records, one of his favorite genres of porn was forced sex. While this level of abuse might sound far-fetched, it's not. I've communicated with so many survivors. I've had people tell me the most perverse details. One woman said her extremely abusive boyfriend was also obsessed with her period blood. He demanded control over her menstrual blood. How do you tell that to a cop? A big problem here, beyond everything I've just told you, is that the weirder it sounds, the harder and more humiliating it is to explain. When it comes to sexual violence, you can't expose your abuser without totally exposing yourself. More of this story after the break. Hey, Believe Her listeners, Lemonada Media now has a great way for you to support our show. You can subscribe to Lemonada Premium, where you'll get exclusive bonus content for the show, like an interview with a gymnast from Mr. Todd's, more detective questioning from the night of the shooting, and one-on-one conversations with other criminalized survivors, some still in prison, some out after decades. Lemonada Premium also includes access to exclusive early premieres and bonus content across all Lemonada shows, all for just $4.99 a month. You can subscribe right now in the Apple Podcasts app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button. Start your free trial of Lemonada Premium on Apple Podcasts today. Thank you.
Every Wednesday, tune into The Deep Dive for a hilarious and heartfelt journey with hosts June Diane Raphael and Jessica St. Clair. From navigating the chaos of motherhood and family to exploring the depths of grief and loss, June and Jessica are two best friends who process life together. Discover their secrets to finding joy amidst the madness. Get ready for unfiltered conversations about life, love, and everything in between. June and Jessica believe in the power of connection and the strength that comes from supporting one another. You can listen to The Deep Dive on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
Nikki was dealing with brutality behind closed doors. And like so many people living through trauma, she was just trying to make it through the day. Here she is, talking to me at Bedford Hills Prison.
I don't know how I did it. It just was a giant blur. It was just day after day after day of getting up, trying to hide whatever was on my body at that point, and be as present as I could for my kids, which was hard and painful physically, and just kind of waiting for it to stop. Like, I just kept thinking, like, eventually this will stop. I mean, you can't do this forever.
Nikki wanted the abuse to stop, but it wasn't happening. Still, her kids were everything to her, and so she showed up for them every single day. When Faye was born, she infused Nikki's life with a new joy. And as Faye grew older, she went from a funny baby to a cheerful, sassy toddler with a head of bouncy dark curls.
The butterfly! Ew! Oh my gosh! I see something on the window!
What is it?
A week before Faye's second birthday, the family moved into Unit 7K at the Duchess Apartments, the scene of the shooting. Nikki decorated the whole place by hand on a shoestring budget. She designed an elaborate play center with a kiddie kitchen, retro dolls, and a stage. Here they are singing the ABCs on that stage. Ben plays the ukulele. Faye is on the mic. The kids had their own little band.
W
I tried to look for moments to hold on to with the kids, and also felt really guilty that there weren't more of them. There's an element of, like, denial in there, too. I wouldn't go there. I just would not let my mind go there. I would just be so involved in the kids and trying to be so present in that moment for them. And I would try to find, like, any little, like, positive thing, any glimmer of something good to, like, hold on to and share and focus on. It was kind of the only way to survive, was to focus on the little moments that were good.
So Nikki's days with Ben and Faye, they were magical. But her nights, they were unspeakable. Chris's family does not believe that he abused Nikki.
I'd give anything for my two boys to have a father like he was, in a heartbeat. And that woman, Elizabeth Clifton.
Yeah,
she's
I'm
a nightmare.
Sure you spoke to her.
Yeah, she'll bang your door down and just come tell you whatever you want to hear. What she wants you to hear.
For people on Chris's side, like his mom Gail and Aunt Tracy, Elizabeth Clifton has been a nightmare. Elizabeth, the kids' music teacher who you met in the last episode, that woman, in her cardigans and wrap dresses, she never stopped insisting she knew what she knew. Elizabeth, for her part, she felt like she lived a nightmare because Elizabeth was in contact with Nikki almost every day. They sent thousands of Facebook messages. They talked about their kids. They talked about vegetable soup. And they talked about horrific abuse.
So this is most of the binders. I have three, I think. All the rest are at John's office. And I took, like, I went through and took notes on what I was reading.
Elizabeth printed out all of these messages. They're kept in thick binders.
This is from January 2016. All right, I said for the first time I was worried about her. You know, like, this is the day I confronted her. You know, like, these are all these things. It's like the slow unfolding of me coming to understand, like, what was going on with her.
Elizabeth says there was a pattern to the abuse. It usually happened at night when Chris got home after a late shift, when the kids were asleep.
So the first time that we were in the middle of messaging and she just flat out, like, disappeared. Like, you know, 1 minute we're talking, the next minute she's gone and not responding. It was absolutely terrifying for me because I had no idea what happened, where she had gone, like, what he was doing to her. Often she'd sort of, like, return again in the, I don't know, like, 10 to 11 o'clock hour. Like, return, when I say return, like, be able to message again. But, like, her messages then would be always very brief, like, one word.
Like, what would the one word be?
Like, I would ask her what happened, and she would just, it'd be, like, hurt or bad, or, you know, like, bathroom floor. Like, a lot of times she'd be on the floor of her bathroom, like, after whatever had happened. And she'd be, like, messaging me from the bathroom until he was, like, coming to knock on the door to get her again.
Nikki says she barely slept those days. She'd message Elizabeth. She'd check on the kids. She'd sew baby slippers, waiting for morning to come. Did you ever doubt her?
No.
Why?
I mean, I was the one who saw it. I mean, who saw her being hurt. I mean, I have literal visual indications of someone who's being injured.
It wasn't just the messages. Elizabeth had seen Nikki curled up in pain. She'd seen her bruised all over. Bruises in a rainbow of colors. She'd seen fresh blood.
I was afraid of her dying. Like, this is what I was afraid of on a daily basis.
And Elizabeth was not alone. Here's Lori, the landlord.
110%, I thought that if I was ever get that phone call, it was going to be for somebody to tell me that she was dead. Like, without a doubt.
And they didn't know what to do.
I know people that, you know, did not testify in the trial that went to the police on their own to say, like, I have a friend that's being hurt and I'm worried, didn't give the names. And the police were like, well, if she doesn't come forward, like, there's nothing we can do. You know, like, people tried.
But for every person who tried to help, there were plenty who didn't see a need. Like Nicole, the gymnastics mom.
There's no flipping way. There's just no way. Because if you knew him as a person, you would say, there's no way. I will say that maybe they had a sex life they didn't want anybody to know about. I mean, that kind of crossed my mind. Like, okay, then. You don't know. You know what I'm saying?
Nicole says Chris didn't have a mean bone in his body. He wouldn't hurt anyone.
Here's the thing. No one ever saw him, Chris, laying a hand on her. No one ever saw that. And I mean, honestly, the thought did cross my mind. Is she self-inflicting herself?
That's fucking insane. I don't say that word lightly. Like, that's insane. I don't know how. I don't know what. I've never heard of anybody hurting themselves in these ways.
That's Elizabeth. Now, Nicole again.
She left that house often to go get coffee, to go visit her friends, to do whatever it is she wanted to do. And Chris never stopped her. Chris left that house every single day. She could have packed her shit, gone right over to the town of Poughkeepsie police and said, I need help. They're going to turn her away? It's just some things just don't sit well and don't add up.
Nikki did try to leave on her own. I talked to three friends who had firsthand accounts of these attempts. She would drive around for hours, but she always went back to Chris. Nikki lived her life in fear. She was terrified of Chris, of losing her kids, of making the wrong choice. And there are no obvious good choices when you're in an abusive relationship. Because the statistics show it can be deadly to stay and it can be deadly to leave. We know from the research that a woman is at a heightened risk of dying when she leaves. Nearly 80% of domestic violence-related homicides occur upon separation. We also know half of all female murder victims in the U.S. are killed by a partner. And there are other factors at play. Let's say you're in a relationship with an abuser who has access to a gun, like Chris did. Then your chance of dying at his hand increases by at least fivefold. Or let's say he abuses you when you're pregnant, which Nikki said Chris did. We know that most homicides of pregnant women are committed by their partners. A person is intricately attuned to what their abuser is capable of. It's how you survive. Nikki knew what was at stake. According to Susan, the midwife, this is what Chris told Nikki.
If you leave me, I'll kill you. I'll kill the children first. I'll kill you. Then I'll kill myself. I'll kill you and I'll get the kids. I'll make it look like an accident. I can't even count how many times I heard the threats. And he always told her, you'll never get these kids. I'll get these kids. You have no support. Your mother doesn't believe you. He told her all the time her mother doesn't believe her. And no one will believe them. And I'm the good person. And I work at Mr. Todd's. And everybody loves me. All the moms love me. Well, isn't it funny that a mom there reported him?
There was one mom at Mr. Todd's who decided to intervene. Her name is Liza Beth. She's a school social worker.
I loved Chris. Chris was wonderful.
To offset the costs of her daughter's gymnastics training, Liza Beth decided to coach a few classes at Mr. Todd's. Chris was her mentor. He taught her everything she knew.
You know, I didn't know a fraction of what Chris knows about coaching, but he was so willing and so wonderful about teaching me.
Liza Beth always liked Chris. But one day in September 2017, she ran into a friend at a pumpkin patch, and her view of him changed.
We were talking and just hanging out, and she said to me, what gym do your kids go to? And I said, they go to Mr. Todd's across the river. And she said, oh, is Chris the is there a coach named Chris there? And she started going on, and she said, well, we're all worried about Nikki. And then I was like, oh, you're talking about Chris. Chris, the head coach, Chris. And I was like, you know, very much in disbelief. And I can remember her saying that people were afraid that it was getting worse, that there were bruises that often were seen on her on a regular basis. And she said, you know, I told my friends I was going to ask you because you're a social worker what to do. And I said, well, why has no one called CPS? Like, why there's kids in the home? Why is no one, you know, called Child Protective Services? And she said, I think, you know, they're scared to. They don't know if they should.
After hearing this, after weighing her options, Liza Beth felt obligated to contact CPS.
Had I gotten this information from my friend and done nothing, and then something happened catastrophically to Nikki or the children, obviously, I would have never forgiven myself. So I would rather live with the discomfort that this choice brought on as opposed to, you know, if something had happened to Nikki or one of the kids.
Liza Beth called anonymously. She made the call that nobody else wanted to make. And everything that had been simmering burst into flames. 6 days after Liza Beth made that anonymous report, two CPS workers in a car with government plates arrived at apartment 7K. They called ahead, so Nikki and Chris were expecting them. The workers kept a detailed log. The home was spotless. Ben and Faye were in good health. Nikki had a visible bruise on her cheek. When a social worker asked her about it, Nikki said it was old. When the worker asked Ben if his parents fought, he told her that they yelled and that his dad grabbed his mom by the arms. Normal fights, Chris said. All parents argue, Nikki said. And then Nikki lied. The worker asked if there were weapons in the house. Nikki said, no. The worker scribbled on the edge of a sheet of paper, are you safe right now? Nikki nodded, yes. And the social workers left. Afterward, Nikki and Chris contacted people they knew the agency would be calling as witnesses. Nikki messaged them, I'm a good fucking mom. He's a good dad. She was so worried CPS would take the kids. She wanted to know who sent them. Chris did, too. That's why they called Susan, the midwife. Remember?
And as soon as CPS left, Nikki and Chris called me.
Nikki trusted Susan more than she trusted any doctor. So even after Faye was born, Nikki sometimes went to Susan for care. They stayed in touch.
And she said, Chris says everything's going to change now. Of course, he's there with her. Chris says that he wants to get help. I said to him, you know, Chris, this, you have a family to take care of. Whatever shape your family takes is different. But, you know, this is a time to make some changes. And he says everything's going to be great. I've got it taken care of. It's all going to be better.
Susan had a lot of information about her interactions with Chris and what went down after that CPS visit. But those stories never made it to Nikki's trial.
I think her whole life was self-defense. I think she acted in self-defense. That young man was hurting her. I think he was going to kill her that night.
Like Susan, many people think Chris had one supremely violent final plan. Nikki testified. Chris said he was going to kill her and himself. But that's not what happened. Nikki lived. And for that, she would be severely punished. Right now, you might be thinking, it's obvious that Chris was abusing Nikki and she acted in self-defense. Next week, on Believe Her, we'll talk about the bad facts in Nikki's case. The inconvenient, inconsistent facts that a lawyer has to explain to a jury. There were other men involved with Nikki, and she could never seem to find the right words to explain what was happening to her.
When we talked about it, it was really, I think, the first time that she was trying to put these pieces together. If you ask her, she will say, you know, I have those flashes of memory, but I can't see his face.
Believe Her is a co-production of Lemonada and Spiegel and Grau. I'm your host and lead reporter, Justine Vanderloon. This series is produced by me and our supervising producer, Kristen Lepore. Our associate producer is Julia York. Our production assistant is Rory James Leach. Additional reporting by Kristen Lepore and Julia York. Story editing by Jackie Danziger. Story consulting by Amy Metch. Mixing and sound design by Keegan Zema. Music by Sara Abdallah. Fact-checking by Justin Klosko. Additional audio engineering by Ivan Kuriev. Our executive producers are Stephanie Whittles-Wax, Jessica Cordova-Kramer, and Spiegel and Grau. Special thanks to Michelle Horton for archival tape. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic abuse, use a safe computer and contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at thehotline.org or call 1-800-799-7233. If you have experienced sexual assault and need support, visit RAIN at rain.org. That's RAINN.org or call 1-800-656-HOPE. Help others find our show by leaving us a rating and writing a review. Follow us at Lemonada Media across all social platforms or find me at Justine VDL. You can also get bonus content and behind-the-scenes material by subscribing to Lemonada Premium. You can subscribe right now in the Apple Podcasts app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button. If you want to continue the conversation with other listeners, please join our Believe Her podcast community on Book Clubs. Join for free at bit.ly/Believe Her Book Clubs. That's bit.ly/Believe Her Book Clubs, clubs with a Z. Thank you so much for listening.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us on Archetypes, a dynamic podcast hosted by Megan, the Duchess of Sussex, as she digs into the labels that try to hold women back. In each intimate and candid conversation, Megan is joined by guests like Serena Williams, Mariah Carey, Paris Hilton, Issa Rae, and Trevor Noah as they delve into the roots of countless common descriptors of women, like diva, crazy, dumb blonde, and the B word, and redefine and reclaim each identity along the way. The complete season of Archetypes is out now wherever you get your podcasts.